pleasure now to introduce Dr. Kay Dickerson, who's a member of the Institute of Medicine, one of the three honorific bodies that controls this. Somebody here who has an IOM member told me that if you showed his IOM card when we came in and said, if you have an IOM membership card, you're allowed to sleep in the library. Do you know if that's true? I'd like an confirmation of this hypothesis. So Kay is a professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, and director of the Center for Clinical Trials. You can imagine how important that is, and then what that entails in terms of both intellectual and organizational factors. She's also the director of the U.S. Cochrane Center, which she's going to talk about now. And just as I was telling Kay, we've been looking for other models where professions have tried to deal with high levels of uncertainty, where knowledge is distributed over many sources, needs to be brought together in a way that's collaborative rather than confrontational. Somebody used a different term earlier, and I've learned about the Cochrane Collaborative, some work I was doing in medical decision making, and I was just kind of blown away by what they've been able to do in terms of institutionalizing collaboration. So she'll be telling us about what they're doing, and we can think about, you know, what are the relevance both in the science for the judgment that goes into decisions and in the organization for this. Okay, thank you for coming.
Given the time, give me a little tea when I should wind down, okay? Because I want to keep you on time, but I'm going to show you some internet things, which could be rather open-ended. Okay, so I wasn't sure what all would interest you for your deliberations, and I thought maybe you should ask me questions first, and then I get an idea. But I made some guesses, and then I did some, it's a wonderful thing about PowerPoint, I did some quick deletions, hearing the word uncertainty, because that certainly is part of what we do. And that your questions will really help me focus more, so hopefully I'll have some time here. So let's just start with this idea of a systematic review. Now, how many of you know what a systematic review is? Okay, good. Well, I'll try to cover it quickly. It's a review of existing knowledge that uses explicit scientific methods. And that is, you have a methods section in a systematic review, a results section, a discussion section. So it's not the typical type of literature review that we weren't taught how to do, but we were supposed to know how to do. It's something that's systematic and scientific. There's a protocol that you do ahead of time. The protocol in Cochrane goes through peer review, and you have explicit criteria for how to search the literature. You say ahead of time exactly what that strategy will be, which sources, and so forth. Now, sometimes when the data from separate but similar studies are similar enough, you do what's called a meta-analysis, which is a quantitative summarizing of the results from these separate studies. So this is just a graphic of a typical, let's see, do I have a pointer here? Oh, yeah. So this is all reviews. Then systematic reviews are a subset of that. And then a subset within there are systematic reviews that have meta-analyses, the quantitative summation. And then sometimes, if you're lucky, you can get everybody who did a similar study to give you the actual patient data. And then you can use those data and do what's called an individual patient data meta-analysis. So that sometimes pictures are much easier to understand than words. So this could take me a long time, but I'm going to try to go through it quickly because I think it very dramatically shows you why we decided in medicine we need systematic reviews and meta-analyses. They were done, as many of you may know, way ahead of medicine, a good 10 years ahead of medicine in, a good 50 years ahead of medicine in agriculture, and then in education and psychology in the 70s, where the term meta-analysis was coined. And then in the mid-80s, medicine started to realize that the meta-analysis and systematic review is something that might be useful to them. So this was a study in the 90s done by Elliot Antman, Joe Lau, Tom Chalmers, and their colleagues. And they said they took a whole bunch of different questions, medical questions, and I'm just showing you one. They said, What if we had known and kept track of all along the studies that were being done, and every time a new study on the same topic was done, we threw it in the pot quantitatively, so that as studies were ongoing, we would see whether a new intervention worked or not. And so they looked at thrombolytic therapy for people who'd already had a heart attack, a myocardial infarction. And the first study was done in the 50s. It had 23 patients. Now, what this is an odds ratio. And an odds ratio of 1 means the ratio of mortality in the group getting thrombolytic therapy compared to the group not getting thrombolytic therapy is 1, or there's no difference between the two groups. These are 95% confidence intervals, so when those confidence intervals cross 1, it means that we're not confident that there's a statistically significant, that there's a difference between these two groups, okay? So here in the 1950s, there was one study done with 23 patients. You can see it's to the left of 1, this point estimate, which favors thrombolytic therapy, but it's not statistically significant. By the mid-70s, there had been 15 studies done with over 3,000 patients. And by that time, if you keep adding the new studies as they're done into the old ones, so the sample size is increasing, it was a statistically significant effect, a beneficial effect of thrombolytic therapy. But no one was keeping track. And so we actually had a good estimate that thrombolytic, of the efficacy of thrombolytic therapy. And in terms of ethics and science, no more trials should have been done. These confidence intervals didn't cross 1, so we didn't know exactly how big an effect it was. But we had enough evidence from the 70s, let's say the early 70s to the mid-70s, to say, hey, this therapy works. But still in the U.S., people weren't using thrombolytic therapy, which is like clot-busting drugs. So the trials continued so that by the mid-80s, 43 clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, have been done with over 20,000 patients. And we have a very good estimate of just how well this therapy worked. But we were still doing trials. That means patients were signing on the dotted line saying, yes, I'm joining this trial because I will help knowledge and I will help understand whether this therapy really works. But if anybody had been keeping track, they would have known we knew that it worked. And still the trials continued into the 1990s, and over about 50,000 patients were randomized. So this pointed out quite clearly that we blew it by not keeping track in a formal way of what was going on. But as you know, medicine isn't organized. You're sort of on your own to keep track of things. Now, not only was this happening if we had been keeping track, but the authors looked at review articles and books at the same time. And thrombolytic therapy wasn't even mentioned until the 70s, and then it was mentioned as an intervention that was experimental, even though at that time, if we had been looking, we would have seen it was beneficial and statistically significantly so. As a matter of fact, it wasn't recommended for routine use until the mid-1980s, by which time we had known for 10 years, if we'd been keeping track, that this really worked. So books and review articles weren't doing much good. Now, M means meta-analysis. Once a meta-analysis and systematic reviews started being done, then you see that thrombolytic therapy started being recommended, both for specific and routine cases. So that hit medicine pretty dramatically, that we need to do systematic reviews and meta-analysis. Not everybody's doing it, but at least a group of people recognized we need to move forward in this way. So the way knowledge moves in medicine is you start with these evidence generation through clinical trials, randomized clinical trials that would test one intervention against another, other types of studies too, observational studies, and then they're combined in systematic reviews. And the group I'm going to talk to you about today is the Cochrane Collaboration, and that's what we do, is we do systematic reviews of clinical trials. And then from those systematic reviews, the evidence is looked at by policymakers and professional societies who write up practice guidelines, because doctors don't have time. I won't show you slides, but they don't even begin to have time to read systematic reviews for every question they have. They need short little things telling them what to do. from a trusted source so that they know someone has read the evidence and they need something like guidelines. So far, many guidelines have been consensus-based, expert-based, and not evidence-based, which is a problem we still have, but there is a movement towards evidence-based guidelines. And then finally, the knowledge is translated into policy and what we call evidence-based medicine or evidence-based healthcare. And I won't go into the definitions we have here, but it's not just evidence, obviously. It's the physician's knowledge and expertise. It's the patient preferences. So evidence-based medicine isn't just evidence. There are other components to decision-making. So I'm going to focus on the systematic review piece here. Now, over the last couple of years, there have been a number of different publications and a lot of conversation and now laws having to do with something called comparative effectiveness research. And you won't hear this from everybody, but the way I look at it is that comparative effectiveness is a new way of saying clinical trials, evidence-based medicine, and so forth. That is comparative effectiveness. You're comparing at least two interventions to see what works so that we can answer the questions that doctors have. And a doctor's question might be, what works best? Well, in a clinical trial, you can't actually ask the question, what works best? You're always comparing one against another or two others or three other interventions. So somehow we have to look at this mass of data using systematic reviews to figure out what works best. Okay, it's really hard to do this. There's a huge information overload, as you know, too much to read, and there was a calculation made that general clinicians wanting to keep up would have to read 19 articles a day, 365 days a year. Well, nobody can do that. So we have to come up with a system, and we haven't come up with that system. We're partway there, but we haven't come up with that system just yet. First, everyone has to buy into the idea that they're going to allow other people to tell them what works and to really have a trusted source. So I'm going to tell you about the Cochrane Collaboration. It's a group that does systematic reviews for the purpose of helping people make decisions about healthcare. So they prepare, maintain, and disseminate the results of these systematic reviews, not just of interventions, for example, of drugs, but also behavior, procedures, and how different health systems work. So, for example, does it work to give a doctor a reminder about a patient needing a test on a regular basis? Does CME, continuing medical education, work? Do doctors actually learn from continuing medical education and so forth? So anything related to health and healthcare. Now, the Cochrane Collaboration is named after Archie Cochrane, but he was dead by the time that it was formed. And I won't tell you that story, but I just want to dispel any. Some people think it was founded by Archie Cochrane, but it was named after him because after the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, was formed after World War II, he said, well, this is great that healthcare is free to people living in the UK, but does it work? So all effective healthcare should be free, but it shouldn't be free if it's not effective. And since he really touted this idea, that's why it's named after him. So this is the first meeting of the group, and I show you just to tell you there is a great spirit about the people in the Cochrane Collaboration. We met in 1993. It was 70 people from 9 countries, and basically, and I'm not in this picture because I was taking it, which I always regret, and I was wearing red too, so you would have seen me. But anyway, it was started by a guy, he must be around here somewhere, Ian Chalmers. He's the guy who came up with the idea, and Archie Cochrane had been his mentor. And in the 80s and 70s, actually, he had gathered together all the evidence for the perinatal field, pregnancy and childbirth and the first 21 days after childbirth for the infant. And he pulled together all the randomized trials and then somehow convinced his friends to do systematic reviews and meta-analyses on topics related to childbirth and the neonatal period. And then it worked so well, he said, hey, let's do this for all of medicine. And so these are the crazy people he got together who wanted to do this. And I would say the Cochrane Collaboration is a mix of people who are both idealistic and also very critical. And so they're critical of themselves too, which has been very good for the collaboration. So it's 16 years old, and in that time, we've grown to about 23,000 active contributors in 100 countries. And it's we work almost entirely electronically. We meet once a year all around the world, not because we want to meet in exotic locations, but because we really need to meet, and we can't meet in just one place. We have to be accessible to everybody. So our main product is called the Cochrane Library, and initially, you know, this was just a homegrown type of thing. Now John Wiley and Sons bid for it, and they're our publishers, and it comes out quarterly, and we're moving towards a continuous publication. It's online, and you can also get CD-ROM in case you live in a country where online access is sporadic. We now have over 5,000 protocols and completed reviews, and the Cochrane Library is a one-stop shopping, so it also includes everybody else's reviews as well in the database of abstracts of reviews of effectiveness. So if you can't find a Cochrane review on your topic, you can look here elsewhere. And I always use an example of a relative of mine who has had multiple fractures, an elderly woman, and she wanted to know whether she should continue to take bisphosphonates, which they give you for your bone mineral density, after 10 years, because she'd heard rumors from her friends that maybe you shouldn't, your teeth would fall out. So I went in looking for her, and there wasn't a Cochrane review. Cochrane reviews don't allow any commercial influence, so you can't take any money in doing a review from any commercial sources. And we looked in other people's reviews. It wasn't there. There was something in health technology assessments, which come from all over the world, although it wasn't for someone who'd had multiple fractures. So if you can't find what you're looking for, oh, and this is also a register of more than 500,000 clinical trials, much bigger than Medline. And this, by the way, I won't say much about it, although we coordinated it at the U.S. Cochrane Center, is we've built this register of controlled trials, which our systematic reviewers use, by not only Medline searching and Embase and Lilacs and CINAHL and all the different electronic databases, but by hand searching page by page over 2,400 journals, which are hand-searched by people who are volunteers. Most of the collaboration is volunteers, by the way. People who are just trying to get it right. So this is the a screenshot, and it was supposed to fly in and do animations, but it didn't, it looks like. So I've blown up where you put in the search term and where you can get help if you're a new user. And if we have time, I can show you how this works. But this is just what you would get if you went online and typed in www.thecochranelibrary.com. It would let you see the reviews up to a point. You'd see the structured abstract and the plain language summaries. It wouldn't let you get into the nitty-gritty. Now, all the reviews are put in a homegrown software called Review Manager, which and so all the reviews look exactly the same. And if we have time, I'll show you. But we are standardized in that way, and we're standardized in many ways. And all this started from scratch, but we started from the beginning at this kind of thing. So we're actually very productive. I do this to sort of show off that here are the other groups in the U.S. producing systematic reviews. This is how many reviews they produced in 2006, and this is how many Cochrane produced in 2006. So the point is there's a lot of leveraging. There's a huge investment by governments in other countries and also foundations in other countries. And so the U.S. Can put in a little bit and get a lot out because of all the leveraging of working together towards this common goal. So the U.S. is a major contributor. The U.K. is the biggest investor right now and also has the most number of people working on reviews. But we are the second highest number of people and also review producers. However, for our population, we're down at the bottom. So we actually don't do much in the Cochrane Collaboration compared to what we could do. There's a huge amount of potential, but the funding, which I'll get to later, is a bit of a problem. So how are we organized? I'm going to run through this fast because it's not as interesting as the reviews itself, but it does seem relevant to you and what you're doing. It's a loose network of willing participants. And one of the things that Americans have a hard time with is they'll come to me as director of the U.S. Cochrane Center. I'm responsible for, I'm like the main contact. If you want to get involved, you'd come to me and say, I really want to get involved. And I say, well, what are you interested in? They say, well, you know, I'm interested in COPD. And so I'd hook them up with the Airways group, and I'll show you there are a number of different groups that are sort of health problem related. But I think as Americans, we wait for people to come to us and tell us what to do. And we've had a hard time with the fact that, no, it works that you go to the review group and you say, I want to do this, and then you do it. Everybody will say, okay, great, get going. You know, here's the handbook, here's how to do it, here are the courses if you need to take some training. But no one will say to you, please do this, and I'm going to lead you through it. You're really on your own. So there are 51 what are called review groups, and they're the ones who actually do the Cochrane reviews, and they're like editorial groups. They're like journals, since this is all electronic. It's the only way I know to describe it. So there are what we call editorial bases. So the Eyes and Vision editorial base is in London at the London School of Hygiene, and their editors, though, for the Eyes and Vision group are all over the world. They're not just in England. So it's not that this is a British operation. It's just that's where the editorial base is, because they raised their hand and said, all right, I'll take on the responsibility for finding the funding. You have to bring your own funding. No one's going to give you funding to do anything in Cochrane. You bring your own. So there are 51 review groups. The fields don't do reviews themselves, but it's a gathering place for people with similar interests. So if you're in child health or you're interested in complementary medicine, you might join the complementary medicine field, but then you would work with all the 51 different review groups to make sure that whether they're talking about heart or whether they're talking about eyes and vision or whether they're talking about hypertension, they consider complementary medicine. Their methods group, and they're the ones who have developed all our methods. Everything that we do in Cochrane, the statistical methods group, the bias methods group, the information retrieval methods group, they've developed all our methods. And our methods are evidence-based. And we have a handbook, and we have a lot of online materials for training people, but we don't use any methods that aren't evidence-based. So if the research needs to be done to find out how do you best search Medline, we've done that research. If the research needs to be done, do we need to hand search journals page by page in addition to Medline searches? We've done that research. And it's published. And then there are 13 centers with their associated networks as well as branches. And we're the U.S. Cochrane Center, so we're the single U.S. Cochrane Center. There's one branch in San Francisco. And we provide the training and coordination for the whole collaboration. So there we are. There's also a consumer network. So consumers are involved in absolutely everything, from starting out the protocol. They comment as peer reviewers on the protocol, the completed review. They have done reviews themselves. They are responsible for the plain language summaries that accompany each review, and they're fully integrated. They teach workshops and so forth. And then there's an elected steering group. And the steering group has representatives from each of these what are called entities. There's a secretariat. We have a CEO. And, for example, he negotiates a contract with Wiley. But the intellectual foundation comes from the steering group. This is our website, kind of. I put some fake things on there that are on the next page down. So, and on our website, we would tell you what's upcoming. There's a lot of training that goes on, and we provide training for everybody, not just Cochrane. When we first started out, the 70 people, we said we wanted our reviews to be free. Well, we couldn't do that. So you get a subscription to the Cochrane Library. Probably most of you have access and don't even realize through your library. But you can also buy an individual subscription for a couple $100. Whole countries have subscription. India has a subscription, the UK, Denmark, Norway, Spain, Australia, Saskatchewan, Wyoming has a subscription, so that every resident of Wyoming has free access to the Cochrane Library. In the U.S., our citizens could have free access. Congress would have to authorize purchase of a subscription for everybody in the U.S. to have access, which, of course, makes sense. So on our website, you can get access to at least down to the structured abstracts. You can take any of the courses, sign up. You can see what events there are. We have different videos. Cochrane was on ER, so we have a little video there. We have an online course that I've done with Musa Mayer on evidence-based healthcare. It takes about 6 hours, and it's free. It's been taken by thousands of people all over the world, and it's pretty high level. It was designed for consumer advocates, so it's in as plain language as possible, but if you forget what a 95% confidence interval is, we go through it in here, and it's required by graduate courses. We've been pretty amazed. So the process is, as I said, it's sort of bottom-up, and authors identify something they're interested in. They go to the editorial group, and they say, we want to do this review, and they follow strict procedures that are laid out in the handbook and get training where they need it. And they commit to updating. So we say when someone says, I want to do a review on this topic, we say, you're signing up for your whole life. Because they have to be updated. They probably have to be updated every couple of years. And so people can't just commit to doing a one-off review because it might be harmful to patients to depend on a review that was done even a couple of years ago. So these reviews are regularly updated. That's unlike any of the other systematic reviews that I know of here in the U.S. Now, this is a really important slide. I know it takes some time, but it's very important to all of us, and we always remember it in everything we do, is our values that were set out from the beginning. What are our values? And whenever we sort of go off track, we come back to our values and realign what we're doing. The last value, enabling participation, was added after the rest, just a couple of years in the 1990s, because we realized that people from developing countries weren't as able to join us because of the high costs. Maybe their computers didn't have the same kind of internet connections. We want to make sure that women have leadership roles the same as men and so forth. So these are very important values. And it's not here, but we all want to have fun, too. We are committed to high-quality reviews. From day one, we had a handbook that we developed on that, as I said, is evidence-based and a lot of training. And then the methodologists are an integral part of everything. Every colloquium that we go to is a full week long. It's 5 days long. It's a long time away, especially if you have to go to Singapore or Australia or something. And then we found out early on that at this colloquium, one of our purposes was to alert the people in the country that we were, what we were doing, so that countries would become aware of the Cochrane Collaboration, and the people who were in the countries doing that work would get some credit from their local authorities. But we also realized that in doing this, we weren't staying ahead because we were telling everybody else about our methods. And so we also have a meeting where we exchange information and learn new methods and explore them ourselves and present our research to one another. And I mentioned our stringent conflict of interest policy about taking money from commercial sources. So as I said, we have this multiplier effect by the funding coming from many sources that supports the infrastructure. And the argument I always try to make is if you fund the infrastructure, you're going to get a lot for free because we have so many volunteers. Authors aren't paid for their work. Methodologists aren't paid for their work. Most of us work in academic institutions, and we can integrate our Cochrane activities into the rest of what we do. I'm going to give you the example of the UK, however, which has given a good amount of funding to the Cochrane Collaboration. But when you look at it as a whole, the Cochrane funding is really a small amount compared to the whole, well, 4.5%. What they do is fund infrastructure of the review groups, the UK Cochrane Center, and then they have an annual award scheme. And they give about £115,000 to each review group, and the cost of their review is quite cheap then, about £10,000, compared to when they commission groups for their NICE, if any of you have heard of NICE, which produce medical guidelines. Those commissioned reviews cost about 10 times as much because they don't build on the contributions of others the way that it happens in Cochrane. In the U.S., we have real challenges with funding. I'm not sure why we aren't funded well. People say it's because it's not invented here. Other possibilities are that with NIH, which is a sort of disease-by-disease entity, we don't have overall funding. And NIH funds R01s with research hypotheses. There isn't infrastructure funding. So we don't have a large role in the Cochrane Collaboration. And from time to time, you'll hear some bitterness about that we are a rich country that isn't pulling its weight. and these other countries, even very small countries, are making a large contribution to what Cochrane is doing. So we don't know the reason. We're hoping with comparative effectiveness research that people recognize what Cochrane is doing and make the investment, but we also have some smaller investments such as the evidence-based practice centers and other investments that are already sitting there, which may just be beefed up instead of investing in this global enterprise. Okay, so I don't know if I have time. What do you think? What I was just going to do you a quick run through the Cochrane Library to show you. Okay.
I knew that you all would be amazed that this is going on and people don't know about it. And now let's sort of figure out how do we make this build on this for our mission. Gary?
I was visiting the library.
Oh, great. Good. That's perfect.
And our issue is what ideas we can take from this in the issue of intelligence analysis. And even thinking about, you know, the basic studies, let alone the review studies, I don't know if it's fair to ask you this question since you haven't been thinking about intelligence analysis as much as we have, but can you even imagine randomized clinical trials in such a setting, or is it going to be more like education research?
One of the things I'm amazed at as an epidemiologist is, because I wasn't trained originally just to do randomized trials, is that epidemiologists who are methodologists haven't organized themselves the way clinical trials have. It's weird. So, for example, we've done all this methodologic research on how to interpret the results of randomized trials, how to find them. We have a register of trials. There's no such thing in observational studies. We haven't organized that. So I think exactly the same thing should be done for observational studies, but who's taking the lead? So I think you could do this. It doesn't have to be randomized trials at all. You should do systematic reviews of observational studies of any design. And I didn't show slides. It depends on what question you're asking. It doesn't matter what the study design is. If you want to know the prevalence of, you know, whatever, you must do a systematic review, not a non-systematic, but someone has to take the lead. And I think that's part of the lesson here is who takes the lead. In this case, it was one person got his friends together and said, let's do it. And the friend said, okay, we don't have money, but somehow we're going to do this. We don't know if it'll get us promoted, but okay. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Bruce?
So I'm going to make a stretch to get this on the topic of intelligence, though the question really isn't. So part of the problem in assessing intelligence is in sometimes speaking truth to power, telling them what they don't want to hear. So as that is a segue to make it relevant to this committee, so what are the areas of medical treatment where national health care works, and what are the areas where it doesn't work?
You mean national health care, like in the UK?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Single-payer plans.
You know, I don't know all the answers, but because to some extent it's where people don't have access to care, that's kind of a secret. You know, people from the U.S. don't get to hear that too much. But if you ask people, they will say not everybody has access to care. If people were getting evidence-based care, then they wouldn't have needed the Cochrane collaboration. They wouldn't be investing in it. They wouldn't be investing. The UK, for example, is investing a huge amount in how to disseminate what comes from the systematic reviews and how to ensure that the purchasers in the different regions know about the evidence and use it. And so they wouldn't be making that investment if it was just working perfectly. But I think they're a smaller country, and many of these countries are smaller, not Australia. And I think just looking at them over a period of years, that the size of the country is a huge factor. In this country, our sense of autonomy, I think, is our biggest barrier. it's not exactly what you asked, but I think some of those cultural things, I mean, for example, in the NHS, everyone in England is very, very proud of the NHS, and they want it to work.
Yeah, I'm trying to ask a more precise question than that. I'm trying to get out of the question of pride and emotional response and so forth. If we looked at mortality studies across the various sorts of problems, ailments, and so forth that Cochrane covers, and we did a comparison between countries that have single-payer plans, employer-based plans, other kinds of plans, looking at the meta-studies within those categories, we ought to be able to see comparatively whether what areas have advantage in single-payer, what areas have advantage in not having single-payer. Has that analysis not been done?
I'm afraid I'm out of my depth on that question.
Okay.
I have a question. So what we've heard, and I don't know how accurate, is that, you know, so my impression is that in the intelligence community, people are working flat out. There's a very large demand on production, a wide range of problems, and it's the whole world, and there's really not that many analysts. And so this is a work where people who are extraordinarily busy, you know, and they've got some, a lot of them have patients and day jobs and teaching and so on. Somehow or other, there's people are taking time out to do this infrastructure work for the sake of their profession. So how are they able to do that?
Every time I see a colleague, they say the same thing: I'm drowning. So we're flat out too. For speaking only for myself, I know that by the time I get to the Cochrane Colloquium, which is always in October, and we set it up that way because the women didn't want September because of their kids, so it's always a consensus. By the time I get there, I'm ready to quit because this is unfunded. I mean, the way I fund the U.S. Cochrane Center work, you wouldn't believe it. We're funded on a conference grant for under $100,000 a year. For all the work we do, and everyone in my group works on other things and works for free for Cochrane because we really believe in it. So we have hardly any funding. And so by the time I get there, I'm ready to throw in the towel. I've had it. And then I'm around these people who want to make a difference from all over the world, and they are making a difference, and I get re-energized. So I do think, and I'm thinking more and more because I'm getting more and more flat out, as we all are, is that one of the things we aren't doing right is we aren't spending enough time with other people that we like. And I think we actually could get more done and do more if we did that.
The institution, the medical institution that people work at, and you know, unlike most of us who are in the liberal arts, you're largely on soft money, so you have to write grants and so on. How does this fit into the reward, this, you know, this fundamental work, how does it fit into the reward structure of, you know, of medical institutions?
I think that's worked. Everyone was very worried about the reward system, but I think people do recognize what you're doing, and I think, although they still will call systematic reviews secondary research, which it's really the hardest research I've ever done of any kind. It certainly isn't secondary in all the implications. But I think the reward system's working out okay, at least for me. I'm not a physician, but I think that actually there's been a big recognition. We just got our first impact factor last year for Cochrane, the Cochrane Library, and this is the first time we've ever had it. We didn't ask for it before, and it's something like 4.67. We're really happy about that. So we had a question.
Are there any data on, let's say, the proportion of doctors in Wyoming who sign on to Cochrane and how often they sign on?
That's a great question. No, I haven't seen it. The people who lobbied for that are the librarians, the public librarians in Wyoming.
Excluding Wyoming, are there data in other places that indicate whether or not physicians are interested in
I don't know if there's any way to tell that they're doctors. That's a problem. One of the things we've suggested is, what if the American Academy of Ophthalmology bought a subscription for its members, and then we could see how many people are trying to get in from there. So that hasn't been tried. It's just country by country now.
Let's say Let's, Amy, and then Tom, and then Ed, and then we'll have to close off the session.
Can you talk a little bit more about the diffusion of knowledge part of the Cochrane Group? Because it strikes me that that's a very useful analogy, where you have a set of volunteers, which is not the analogous case, volunteering their time, coming up with really important findings. How do you get the practitioners then to adopt those findings? What are the challenges you face, and how do you overcome them?
That's our big challenge. It's a huge challenge. Even in a country like England, we aren't necessarily successful. But I think some of the countries now, like Canada, has just asked and put a fair amount of money towards knowledge translation. So it didn't even have a term before. Now it's called knowledge translation. In this country, what we call translation is from the bench, getting from the bench to clinical trials. But we need to start funding knowledge translation because we don't know much about it. The studies we've done of, for example, continuing medical education, which is along the lines you're talking about, show that it doesn't work. So we have to do more of those studies to see what does work.
Thank you. I can think of rough analogs to use in the intelligence world, both on sourcing, source reliability, utilization of them, and evaluation of products. But I wondered if any part of this is automated, or if it is still all manual of going through.
I'm not sure what you mean automate. I mean, the whole thing is software. We have an information management system. But you do have to take the data out of the papers that you're reading and put them into the software. Now, there are some people who have worked on doing using informatics to extract data. Ida Sim, for example, at UCSF is looking at how to take results out of papers and then directly put them into software like this. The problem is most papers aren't well written. And so it's very hard to get the data you need. Now, all of us wear multiple hats. Very few people are just Cochrane people. So, for example, one of the methods, people in the methods groups are working on these reporting standards, like the Consort standard and Quorum and Mooser, all these different reporting standards now. And the journals, if the journals take them up, then the papers will be written in a standardized way, and it would be easy, not easy, but it would be possible to automate extraction of the data and put it into the software. But the papers now are pretty terrible. I mean, you can even read into the discussion section. It's not till then you find out the study's randomized.
Ed, here. Can you hit the...
A brief question on methodology. You had mentioned earlier that you thought it would be doable to have a comparable collaborative on observational studies or perhaps other kinds of, but I'm just wondering how doable that really would be. The methodological challenges, the minute you move away from the randomized clinical trial, you know, the additional assumptions you have to make and so on. And when I'm thinking about with the intelligence community, we would be very far from anything approaching a clinical trial at this point. We've seen some examples where it might be possible to do one or two little things in-house. So I'm just wondering, when you talk about meta-analysis for large numbers of non-randomized studies, do you really think the methods are there?
Well, one of the things the methods aren't there. That's what I was saying, is that we're really pretty far along in developing methods for randomized trials. There's still lots to be done, but we've been working on it 20 years. One of the things, and there is a one example of observational studies, and that's called HugeNet, and it's through CDC, and it's all studies, epidemiologic studies of etiology that include genetic information. And so that's an example where there is something like Cochrane for genetics and their influence on etiology. One of the things that really helps, I think, with observational studies is breaking it down by type of question. And I'm sorry that I didn't put that slide in. But so, for example, you could have, here are the studies that address questions of etiology. Here are studies that address questions of prognosis. Here are studies that address questions about diagnostic accuracy. Those all would use observational studies, but they're quite different types of studies, and you might have a collaboration that just looks at one type of question, or at least it divides itself up by type of question. First, you have to find out what's out there and then categorize it.
Well, let me thank you very much. And-